Hey, it's Kristen. You're listening to Rational in Portland.
Welcome to Rational in Portland. I'm your host, Kristen. Today, I've got an unprecedented combination of guests. Isaac McLennan, head of the Portland Firefighters Association, that's the Portland Firefighters Union, and Aaron Schmaus, head of the Portland Police Association, that would be the Portland Police Union, are here with me today in the studio.
Welcome, guys. Isaac, this was your idea. I think it was brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, well, no, thank you for having me.
We were just talking off air about this for a minute. How do you think charter reform is going to affect the, we'll start with you, is going to affect the firefighters bureau at all?
You know, I think the restructuring is going to have some changes in how the administrative side and some of the policy changes. And outside of that, it's hard to say, but I think it's definitely fair to say that neighborhood fire stations, the number of firefighters in those stations will not change from the old commission form of government to the new form of government starting on January 1. We obviously will be laser focused on any changes that are going to affect public safety on behalf of Portland Fire and Rescue. We're going to be watching that and making sure the public is aware of any changes that will negatively affect their safety, quite frankly. So we
were also talking off air, and I hadn't thought about this. Renee Gonzalez is the fire bureau commissioner.
Yeah.
But the fire chief actually reports to the mayor currently.
Well, no, currently the fire chief reports to the fire commissioner.
Okay.
Under this form of government. But okay. When we transition, there will be a new administrative side. And that's the change, is that the fire chief doesn't report to an elected official. That's the change in this form of government. That's the main change.
It'll be a bureaucrat?
Yeah, an appointed person. So you have the mayor will, the way I understand it, is the mayor appoints a city administrator. And under that city administrator, of course, that has to be approved by council.
Or the city manager or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's called essentially this, that the title is city administrator, but the city manager is what a lot of people know it as. And then they will have five deputies. And one of those deputy city administrators will be the deputy city administrator of public safety. It's a mouthful.
And they'll handle police too?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the mayor, my understanding, at least in the new form, the mayor will still have some say there, but the council has to approve. And I think this, I mean, you look at this election, this is why I think this is so important. You know, I've said publicly very often that people effectively elect their police chief through who they vote for mayor. You're kind of assigning the authority to do so under the current form by who you choose to value. And similarly, as we look at all these different candidates, it's important to listen to their ideology. It's important to understand how they view public safety, because at the end of the day, who you choose for your elected officials are going to have a huge say in who your police chief is, who your city manager is, who will have a significant amount of authority over a public safety system. And so it's very critically important that we're listening well.
And you, I know you've already started endorsements.
Yep.
At least city council candidates.
Yeah.
Did you do mayor too?
We did. We endorsed Renee Gonzalez for mayor.
And who are the city council candidates?
So far we haven't fully rolled it all out. It's interesting, you know, endorsements from my perspective are kind of the candidates to act on. But those who have announced so far, in District 4, we endorsed Eli Arnold, Eric Zimmerman, Olivia Clark, and Tony Morse. In District 2, we endorsed Steve Novick and Dan DeMello. In District 3, we endorsed, so far, just Dan Ryan. And in District 1, so far, just Terrence Hayes.
What should people look for when they're looking for candidates who support public safety?
Listen, right? I mean, the thing that's so interesting, Terrence and I, we've had a bunch of different conversations, because I think District 1 is the most interesting from the standpoint that many of the candidates don't seem to reflect the values of that district at all. And they're not hiding the ball. We've seen this in previous elections where people seem surprised by outcomes. When people put in voters' pamphlets their perspective, and then people seem surprised by the outcomes. Again, just District 1 was my patrol district for a long time, and that is a district that has been unrecognized by our city government for a long time. Terrence is a champion for public safety, but also someone who understands the necessity for accountability and understands what that kind of check and balance system should look like. He is the only candidate that I've spoken to thus far in that district who is not beholden to an ideology that would destroy our city.
People who are curious should go back and listen to his episode. I aired an episode with him, and I've never had my mind changed about so many things so quickly than by Terrence Hayes. Did you meet Terrence Hayes, Isaac? Have you met him yet?
Yes.
He is so flippant impressive. It's wild how he's turned his life around, but also how much perspective he has, I think.
Yeah, this is going to be a difficult election for people to digest, I think.
Yeah.
So where are you going to get your information? Who are you going to listen to? What matters? What issues matter to you? And, I think people need to be laser focused in their district, because there's, 80 some people running for city council for city government right now. When you include all the mayors and the folks running in different districts. So, the question is, how do you choose? Well, I think you need to take careful aim and listen to the candidates speak. And I think Terrence is a perfect example of that. Listen to what he says and what his convictions are, what he wants to do, what his life has been, but how he's going to use that life experience to make Portland the place where we all want to live, where we want to grow a family, where we want to work and play and enjoy this great city that so many of us love. And I think that passion for making sure that we can be safe in our community is really important right now. And safety obviously means a lot of things to a lot of people. I'm a firefighter. I want people to be able to be free from harm. And, if there's an emergency that strikes, we need to be able to get to wherever you are within minutes. And whether it be, from a medical incident or a fire or a car accident, our job is to get there quickly and stop, whatever bad thing is happening and reverse that immediately. That's our job. So from that standpoint, but we also know that Portland operates under a system of public safety. And, we need fire and police, and EMS, emergency medical services, and our 911 system all to work as one system. And crime is a crime or lawlessness bleeds into creating more issues. If we're busy dealing with people that are overdosing in the streets, that means we're not available for another critical call. And if we can reduce the number of people that are overdosing and the need for fire engines and fire trucks to drive to those incidents and deliver a life-saving Narcan, then we can be available for those people that have cardiac arrest or that are involved in a car accident or trapped inside of a burning building. We're no good if we're not there. So that's really how it works out for fire. And if you listen to some of these folks that are running, like Terrence, like so many others that Aaron mentioned, these folks are, it's in their conviction. It's embedded into who they are and what has driven them to run for council. So listen carefully to the candidates and what their priorities are, and not just their priorities, because it seems like everybody's got the same three. It's how they're going to address it and what life experiences and situations brought them there. And I like the other thing that Aaron said about the mayor is that, coming into this new year, we're going to have a new system of government. We're going to have a new mayor. We're going to have a new city council. We're also going to have a new fire chief. We're also going to have a new police chief, and a few other director heads. It's going to be completely brand new. So it's really important that people pay attention to that, because not only does the mayor pick, but the council affirms. So we need to have people in there that have a public safety-minded attitude. A one that's like forward thinking and thinking about how we're going to be safe in our community.
How do we listen to so many candidates?
So I think you listen by asking the second question. So many people, the amount of hyperbole and just like kind of one-liners you hear from so many of these candidates. And he mentioned a lot of the rungs of public safety, and I'll use PSR as an example. So many candidates.
Portland Street Response. Yeah.
So many candidates. They'll just stand there and blink and say the words Portland Street Response, but they don't say what they want them to do. They don't say how they want them to do it. They don't say how they want them to work as a woven partner in the public safety model, as opposed to something that is separate. And what's so interesting, at its origin, it was designed to be something separate. We have a bunch of city employees who are basically told not to work together. And we saw a little bit of that with police and fire during 2020, where police officers were ordered not to shelter in place or to stage at fire stations by the commissioner at the time.
Say more about told not to work together.
Well, for street response or for the...
Well, I guess let's start with street response.
So, I mean, at the origin of the model of Portland street response, the design was a replacement to law enforcement. And this is kind of, you know, much like Measure 110 was a bit of a bait and switch. Originally, it was a concept around concerns about over-policing of certain communities. And all of a sudden, when that became difficult to navigate politically, it was more about health response to addiction. Similarly, street response initially was police are bad. They're going to show up and hurt you. And therefore, we need another group. But then we realized that street response shows up and doesn't have the legal authority or the capacity to actually affect the change that we're looking for in our community. And so the people in charge and the new commissioners, as we had new people elected who were more pragmatic, were like, well, hold on a second. These are all city employees. They need to work well together. And so, you know, and also there are some street response members who were hired under the idea that they wouldn't have to or would specifically not work with law enforcement. And that created a lot of dissonance for them as well. And it's just not healthy. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all city employees. We need to work through our differences. We need to sort out what we're all here to do. But the taxpayers are paying for every single one of us to accomplish a goal, which is public order. And that can only be accomplished if we work together.
Now, talk about the disconnect between police and fire.
Well, police and fire don't have a disconnect. During 2020, at the time, the commissioner in charge directed the fire bureaus to not allow police officers to stage in their fire stations.
What does stage mean?
It means so when we were having riots and we were having significant disorder, we would try to find places for police officers to wait to be deployed. We don't have police stations all over the city the way that we have fire stations because we've cut several police stations. And as a result, there are many fire stations that strategically are useful. But the fire commissioner at the time told and ordered the fire bureau not to allow police to use their stations to stage, which is unsafe.
Isaac, that was, you didn't come in during 2020, but you came in when Joanne Hardesty was still fire bureau chief prior to Renee Gonzalez.
Yeah, the fire commissioner.
The fire commissioner. And she, you all were in trouble, right? I mean, the firefighters weren't well when you came in. It was bad.
There was a lot.
Funding was bad.
There was so much happening.
Morale was bad.
Yeah.
There were no numbers.
What we did not have, I'm an optimist. I like to say that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. I can work with anybody. And she was no different when I came into this job in 2020, when she was in that position. It's like, you're the fire commissioner and I'm the union president. We're going to get some stuff solved. That was my attitude. And I would admit that in any forum. But we had some huge things to tackle. Firefighters working mandatory overtime of 96 hours straight, sometimes even longer. No rest, no reprieve, all last minute. Your family had to sacrifice or face discipline. So you had, obviously, the COVID pandemic. We weren't sheltering at home. We weren't working from home. We were at work. You know, we had, thankfully, we had protective equipment, but we didn't know how this was going to be transmitted. And, you know, in the early pandemic phases, but... And then later,
police too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. We did so without even second guessing it. Why? Because that's what we swore an oath to do. You know, and so yeah, in 2022, you know, it was a struggle, and you know, it wasn't long after that the campaign for the next commissioner started, and you know, our members were just fed up with her. That's just straight. You know, and I adamantly was willing and wanting to work with her, and I just kept hitting nothing but, you know, just closed doors. And I only ever met with her. I never met with her in person ever, only over Zoom, only
her choice. I take it.
Yeah. I'm an in-person guy. People send me a Zoom link. I'm like, where are you working? I'll come to you. I and that's how I operate. I don't do it. I'm not trying to be offensive. If you were like, no, I'm really sick. Like, okay, no problem. But like, if you're, you know, I like having, I like looking people in the eyes and having, that's how we're humans. We're not humans through a computer screen. I get that's a convenient thing to do, but we need to talk to each other first, face to face and have an honest conversation about some really important issues. So, yeah, unfortunately, that relationship with her just never really matured. And so, thankfully, Renee Gonzalez, not only did he win that election, he was placed in the, as a fire commissioner, which he has done an exemplary job. And that's no question. That's why our political action committee and our executive board confirmed that Renee Gonzalez should be the next mayor, and we support him 100%.
And have things improved? Have the number of firefighters improved? Are you still working mandatory overtime?
We are working mandatory overtime because it takes a long time to come out of a hole. It takes about 2 years to make a firefighter, a full-fledged firefighter, from the moment they take an entrance exam to become one all the way until they have been fully trained.
Yeah, just so, like police.
It takes a long time. Yep. So, but that being said, he has fought for us on council to add staffing. He has fought for us on council to supply firefighters with a collective bargaining agreement that's a fair compensation for the work we do. And has been to every single fire station. I don't remember the last fire commissioner that's ever went to every single fire station. I don't think it's ever happened in my 22-year career. It shows that he knows that he can reach out to myself and I can tell him what the will of the membership is. That's my job. But he also knows that there's a benefit to just going right to those people that work there and hear what their concerns are in their neighborhood fire station. What are you dealing with? What concerns do you have? What can I do to make your jobs better or more, make you more effective at your job? What is missing? What can I do? And that's leadership. Not telling us what to do, but asking us what you need. That's true leadership. And that's what he's done. That's why we're supporting him this election.
And I was laughing because it just seems like a no-brainer, something that the fire bureau head commissioner would do. Aaron, what's happening with the police union ballot measures? What is the status?
We had two ballot measures. They were all filed late winter, early like January-ish, early into February. The first one, we did some polling in the late fall. The thing that was so interesting, you know, we always just kind of go to the community and ask them. We have officers who are out there having touch points every day. Our membership, along with fire, we have as many interactions with the public as anyone. It became very clear very quickly that while voters supported the framework of or the concept of a civilian-led oversight and a change in our oversight system, that the system that resulted from a group that demonstrated itself to be very biased was not what they intended. We did some polling. We had felt that way, but we did some polling, and at about a 70% clip, voters said, we just want another crack at this thing.
This is specifically the Police Accountability Commission.
Right. But, you know, we did polling kind of just generally speaking also on what kind of public safety system do you want? I think there's no mystery that our public safety system, there's a lot of discord around what services people want, what they want to have access to. And as a result of that poll, we pushed forward two ballot measures. One was focused on public safety, on the models, the resources available, access to treatment, access to care, enshrining Portland Street Response in charter in a way that would ensure that it would partner well with law enforcement and its funding would continue. All of these things polled at 70 to 80%. And that was found to be administrative on a novel concept that basically, because we suggested there should be more patrol officers, that the ballot measure would be directing the Bureau to hire people specifically to work patrol. Fundamentally, it is challenging for me from the standpoint that there are ballot measures that direct the city government to do all kinds of things, including reform itself. Completely. The originating factors around the accountability system also was quite administrative, but was allowed to move forward, but that was struck down. The second was about the Accountability Commission. We put forward a ballot title. The city auditor adjusted it slightly. We felt that the adjustment was not commensurate with what we were asking, specifically because it spent a lot of time talking about what it wasn't doing and didn't spend a lot of time talking about what it was doing, which can be confusing for voters. The ACLU and some others also filed the challenge, and the judge...
League of Women Voters.
It was mostly... Yes, there were a couple different groups, but ultimately...
Led by the ACLU of Oregon?
Mm-hmm. And the real challenge ultimately, aside from the fact that the ruling changed the title in a way that was we didn't agree with, it took a really long time. And you know, statutorily, these ballot titles, they hang on the edge of a pen because it's very expensive. It takes a lot of time to get things through the system, and there's not an appeal process. So if you don't agree with the outcome, you have to refile. And we filed in February, and again, statutorily, it's necessary for these to move through. The statute says quickly to ensure an orderly process, and it took 4 months. And as a result, we had 5 weeks left to try and, or I think it was a 5.5 weeks to try and gather signatures. And this process, again, is very expensive. And when you have a ballot title that is not commensurate with what you're attempting to allow voters to have a voice on, you have to spend a lot of money to also educate them on the differences between the ballot title and what you're intending. And as a result, we decided to refile, and we intend to do so in the coming months.
Do you have an understanding for those listeners out there that maybe they're like me, maybe they donated to the ACLU at some point in their lives? Do you have an understanding of where they're coming from on these challenges to the police union? Because it seems to me, just from watching what happens in city council, that it goes, it's sort of... The ACLU seems to be interested in challenging the police union at every turn, but I may not be seeing things clearly. Do you have an understanding of what philosophically is going on here? Because aren't a lot of Oregonians watching this or Portlanders watching what's going on in city council just going to say, well, it's the ACLU. They're interested in police accountability. But well, I know that can't be the end of the story.
So, but their perspectives, I mean, look, I don't have a deep desire to get into an ideological fight with the ACLU. I think their perspectives have proven to be obscure as it relates to the values of Oregonians. I mean, you look at Measure 110, Measure 110 was not only deeply unpopular, you had every left, right, and center legislator basically being told by their constituents, change this or you're not going to be reelected. You had a ballot measure that was hanging over their heads that would pass flying colors and completely repeal Measure 110. But you had the ACLU of Oregon and a couple other groups literally just say, if you don't do what we want, we're going to take our ball and go home. And this is, again, where it is very interesting that they say that they are for the Constitution. They are for the constitutional process. They came to our status hearing and complained to the judge that the PPA was speaking out of both sides of its mouth by saying that we didn't agree with the ballot measure, but at the same time, we were working to implement it. And Judge Simon himself said, well, isn't that what we do? I mean, again, it is the right of every American citizen to engage in the laws that exist, but also work to change them if you don't agree, and to engage in the civic process to do that. And their refusal to allow voters to have a voice is perplexing to me. And at the end of the day, I think, again, for every single person I've spoken with, what's important in public discourse is not, again, hyperbole. It's not the obfuscation of facts. It's not, pretending that the issues that we're facing are the issues that are facing other communities. We're in Portland. We have a police force that, even according to several defund sites, is understaffed. We have a workforce that has been obliterated in morale. And we have a workforce that is as accountable as any in the country. Voters voted for a system that would be civilian led. But they did not vote for a system that was deeply biased. They did not vote for a system that in its own system would prevent the city from having autonomy over its own hiring practices and firing practices, which is unlike any community in the country. And so it is very important, again, if there's a question before voters and then the outcome is different than what they intended, that we ask them the question so that they can make sure they get what they asked for. It's the same thing with Measure 110. Two ballot measures that were introduced in the same year that have had significant and harmful impacts on our community. And as a result, it's our responsibility to ensure we get it right.
And of course, we reformed 110, and it sounds like you have new ballot measures coming.
Yes.
That we can look forward to. And so what happens next? I mean, you must be expecting challenges to those as well.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have the same conversation. Again, I think it's important. We will never, the PPA, we've talked to a lot of community members. We've had a lot of community organizations approach us and ask if they can file for us. Because at the end of the day, what we want is for voters to have a voice. We're having a lot of different discussions, again, about what is the best pathway forward. But at the end of the day, we will utilize polling, we'll utilize conversations and community groups to ensure that what we're asking for is just simply allowing voters to have a say in the things they're interested in. If we had not gotten a poll that said, from a very reputable poll firm, and we actually did two when we released
DHM.
One was internal. But nonetheless, we had two polls actually that said that these things were at a 70 to 80% clip interesting to Portland voters. We want to make sure that the people we represent and the people that we serve have an opportunity to engage with each other through the civic process.
Isaac, switching gears for a minute, what is happening with the ambulance situation? Because I just read that Sharon Myron is getting on board in terms of it, in a more active way.
Yeah.
In terms of trying to help rectify that.
Yes. Yeah. Wow, I never would in a million years would have thought that the city of Portland or Multnomah County would all of a sudden just be short on the ability to simply provide ambulances to people who need to take them to the hospital.
And this is a county issue,
correct. Yeah. The county controls the ambulance contract, and they have selected American Medical Response to fulfill that contract. So those ambulances are staffed with two paramedics. And then there's also additional units that are staffed with EMT basics, which is a lower level of training. But usually those units are reserved for what we call low acuity calls, something that's where there's not life critical incidences. So basically the contract dictates that you have to be able to provide an ambulance within 8 minutes of the call. And anytime that does not happen, the county is able to find them. And they're currently in mediation, right, as I understand, regarding the AMR not being able to fulfill the contract. But all that doesn't matter, because in the end, what somebody needs when they call 911 is an ambulance to come and take them to the hospital. Nobody cares about the ins and outs of that. And firefighters are in that same boat.
Yeah, they just want it to work.
It's so infuriating to be on a call where somebody calls 911 and the fire department shows up 4 minutes later, mitigates the scene, and there's no ambulances coming. And then the other family is like, where's the ambulance? Like, there's not one assigned to this call. We're waiting. Your options are to wait, or we can help you get into your own personal car. Or at times the police actually have transported on our behalf. We put them in the back of a squad car. Can you call it a squad car? Is that what you call it?
I don't know. It sounds cool.
People say squad car. I'm not a police officer. So anyway, police car. And, or a city bus. We've transported them in the back of a fire engine. These fire engines are not transport vehicles. If you ever sat in one, you'd feel like you're sitting in some sort of like industrial thing. It's not designed.
It's not nimble.
It's designed to get firefighters and their gear. We have a lot of tools in there and our an emergency scene. It's not designed in any way to transport people. Even when people do ride-alongs, they're like, wow, this is not very comfortable. Yeah. And you're a healthy person, right, doing your ride-along. So, in the end, it's infuriating. And all I've expressed to anybody at the county level who's an elected official who will listen is, please provide more ambulances so that people can go to the hospital. That's what I want. That's all firefighters want. And it doesn't matter what magic serum that is, just somebody driving an ambulance would be helpful. So it's hard. And because, we're on a call waiting for an ambulance to get there, those four firefighters that would normally be waiting and ready to go for another emergency are not available. We cannot leave that scene by law. It's considered patient abandonment. So we have to stay there and wait until this person either elects to go in their own private vehicle, or we can call them a cab if it's appropriate, if they so choose. If you feel their medical needs are stable, we can call them a cab. So that saves the, you know, it's actually a lot cheaper for the taxpayer because some, you know, or for them, whoever's paying the bill. So that's an option, but in the end, it's not a good option. We've already determined as a society what's the best way to get somebody from wherever they are to a hospital. It's called an ambulance. They've been around since, I don't know, the 30s, 40s, 50s, something like that. So it's just perplexing. And here's the other thing, Kristen, is I don't think people in Multnomah County have any idea. I mean, it's when it happens on a call and when it happens and somebody just learns that there's not an ambulance coming, there's not even one assigned, they have no idea how long we have to wait. They start losing their mind, and rightfully so. But that's when people find out, when they're having an emergency, when their family member is in the middle of a seizure or whatever it might be, like that's when they learn it. And so you've already created a very stressful environment because their family member is sick or not well or whatever the circumstances may be. And then you put on the fact that there's no ambulance coming.
Yeah. And I think the thing that's important here too, is that like so often we're talking about public safety, you know, it's fire. People are thinking about something dramatic, like a big fire or whatever else, but it's us, you know, it's some violent scene. When you're having this conversation about ambulances, you're talking about your dad having a heart attack. You know, you're talking about, you know, somebody falling and hitting their head and again, having a seizure, like you mentioned. I mean, you're talking about every day, you know, your kid drowning in a pool. This is where we're failing in a way that is honestly just kind of immoral. And what's really frustrating to me too is, you know, Isaac and I both have gone to meetings. A lot of the ways that the county is looking to triage this issue is by providing less service. And that to me is, again, it's one thing when you have a problem, you got to kind of just band-aid it for a minute. But I mean, we're, you know, talking about, well, you know, if it's a shooter stab call, you know, do we have a victim for sure there? You know, is there, do we have someone that's confirmed in the police world? If someone's calling in gunshots, unless you can, you know, prove that it's not gunshots, you're going, not because the high percentage of mass shootings, because you don't want to miss the one that is. Similarly, if someone says, yeah, I think there's a victim here, you know, again, moments can be deadly for folks. And so it is extraordinarily frustrating to me that we continue to have conversations about how to provide less service in the hope that the system we have will work, when instead we should be focusing on the altruistic goal of having enough people working to get ambulances where they're needed.
Yeah. Isn't there some kind of industry standard about how long, not supposed to wait, but how long we can, any functional city or county would wait for an ambulance? And you might have talked about it last time you came on, Isaac.
The current contract, as I understand, has the requirement that the ambulance arrive within 8 minutes of being notified of the emergency.
Is eight typical? It seems long.
It does. But the way that
we can't even do that.
We're not meeting that. They're not meeting that standard, not even by a long shot. So the reason that that system works, at least with Multnomah County, is that you've got fire stations scattered all over the city. So we respond, you know, our goal is once we're notified to arrive at the scene within 5 minutes and 20 seconds. That's 1 minute to get from whatever we're doing into the fire engine, right? Fire truck, and the 4 minutes, 20 seconds to drive to wherever you are. That's when we arrive. That's our standard.
Are you making that for your calls?
We meet it. I believe the last statistic came out. We were meeting that like 80 or 90% of the time, which is pretty good. That's not great. The goal is 100%.
Strangely high. What about police, Aaron? Do you know? I mean, you all have a queue of calls, right? And then you have to triage calls.
Yeah, our response time is so far off. And it's from kind of soup to nuts, right? The industry standard for 911 calls, you know, it's in the low minutes, right? And we're having 911 calls hold for 6 or 7 minutes at times with our call queue. Non-emergency, which again is where you have the best opportunity to help people feel safe in their community. People are waiting for 2 or 3 hours. That's like Delta Airlines style kind of hold times, right? But then by the time they've done that, then it gets dispatched, and now you get to go to the other line, which is, again, police officers logging on with 40 calls holding and trying to just triage through all that stuff. And so it's very high energy frustration for a lot of citizens. Emergency calls, you know, we should be getting there in minutes, and we're just not. It's unsafe.
And that leads to burnout among police officers. When you log on, you got 40 calls waiting. You're going to burn out your folks. You know, there's no question that we need more police officers, and there's no question we need more firefighters, statistically speaking, so that people are protected, but also so that those folks doing the work are not burned out. We don't want to burn out our frontline folks. that's not going to be safe for anybody.
And you think about it too, is when the bad one happens, you know, for a firefighter, when the big fire happens, if you've gone on 15 medical calls overnight and then all of a sudden you're running into a burning building, that's where mistakes happen. That's where people get killed. You know, when you talk about police officers, it's dangerous from not having enough cover. But the other issue too, is we talk so much about, you know, community support and how do we build relationships with the community? The only pathway there is non-crisis interactions with the public. You know, if a police officer only ever responds to critical incidents, it is natural that they're going to view the world through the lens of crisis. Similarly, when the public only has interactions with police when they're running in, you know, to very dangerous situations, the police aren't responding in a friendly way because they're focused on what they're doing, it's damaging to the relationship. And furthermore, the best cases are solved by non-crisis friendly interactions with shop owners and families. Hey, I saw this thing. Hey, what about this? Where curious police officers can work through these kind of benign or kind of not interesting issues and discover real significant issues in communities. And it's through relationship. And again, you know, police officers about 40 to 50% of their time should be occupied by emergency calls, and it's pushing 70 or 80%. It's not tenable. And at the end of the day, it leads to significant discord. And then when police officers do have that final break, they have an opportunity to not go run around. They're not going to want to go push a car out and talk to people. They want to take a breather. They want to eat, you know, it's just unfortunate.
Are we still having an issue with BOAC, with the Bureau of Emergency Communications?
From the standpoint that they're
old times.
Yeah. I mean, significant. From the standpoint that they're understaffed.
Yeah.
You know, I think we had gotten as low as about 80. I think we're just over about 100 now. The thing that's hard with BOIC is it is, first of all, an incredibly difficult and technical job.
Right. Tell us what is BOIC? What do they do?
So I represent the call takers and the dispatchers. And so you have a big room. It's called the floor. You got a big room and you have people on one side who just all they do is answer 911 calls, and they then make decisions about what calls will be dispatched, and then they send those over to the dispatch, and each dispatch net has a dispatcher. You may have at times, you know, only four or five or six dispatchers for the entire county, which is just patently kind of insane. The thing that's so difficult about that job, again, they work mandatory overtime. I have one dispatcher who worked 32 or 33 days in a row last summer because he got mandatoried over and over and over again. And it is just so difficult for them to get any rest or respite. If you go and do a sit along, they're listening to people on their worst day, trying to navigate very tense situations, call to call to call to call. There's very little break. And it really just is, I think, one of the most difficult jobs that exists. And they don't get enough credit to be the first responders that they are. You know, we've had multiple dispatchers be on the phone with people while they're being murdered, while they're being assaulted. The amount of just trauma and kind of a vicarious or secondary trauma that causes is significant. And they don't get enough credit for the work they do.
Tell us about these sit-alongs. So members of the public, assuming my guess is you clear a background check, kind of like a police ride-along, you get to sit.
Yeah, you can go and sit next to a dispatcher and kind of you put a headset on, listen to the calls as they're coming in, and just kind of understand that environment. And it really is, I think, you know, if you think about any other like customer service, like call line, you think about how frustrated you are when you call, again, just like Verizon or something. Now add in the fact that you're being beaten and there's all this other, people are so difficult to navigate, and the amount of patience and temperance that these human beings demonstrate in humanity and helping people navigate these situations is pretty heroic.
And Isaac, people can ride along with firefighters, can't they?
Yeah, that link is available right on the Portland Fire and Rescue's website. So you can, it's easily find that, and you can fill out an application. And, you know, you generally speaking, it's not, you know, they don't just, my understanding is they don't just give it to anybody. You have to have something.
Wouldn't be safe. Well,
but
that's probably a good thing.
Usually it's people that have like some, there's a reason why.
I understand.
Something, there's something they're doing that is informative to them. You know, most people don't just do it because like, I got a free Saturday, you know. So.
Can I drive the back of the truck like Kramer? That would be rad.
I mean, if you come by my firehouse, we'll see what we can do.
Remind us, which firehouse are you at?
I'm on the east side. I work on 122nd and Madison. It's fire station number 7.
Which one is the busiest?
number seven. Station
number seven. Yeah.
And so you, did you end up there or did you want that?
Oh, I wanted it. It's also the,
it's never boring.
I've been there since 2008 and, it's not only is it, we have an engine, 4-person engine, a 4-person truck, and we also co-staff or cross staff. It's basically that same, those 8 people that are working will also respond on any hazardous materials spill or, incident that happens in the, region.
Isaac, have you all started endorsements of candidates?
Yeah.
And can you say publicly who you've endorsed
We're still in the process.
Still working on it.
Yeah, we're almost through with it. The timing of this recording is probably not great because I think we might be completed by tomorrow.
Okay.
But we are going to, depending on when you push this out, we can certainly provide a link to that. I think, We're going to be in somewhat alignment with the candidates that Aaron shared on the show. And, namely, we're looking into what people are, where people's stances are on public safety, because that's what our interests are. We want to make sure people are safe in their community. We have a vested interest in a thriving Portland. We don't enjoy being in a community and watching it sort of, dissolve from the inside out. You know, this the fentanyl crisis is debilitating. The homeless situation is frustrating because we see it on the front lines. It's not the fact that they're homeless. We know that people are going to be homeless. It's the fact that we allow them to live in a way that is so inhumane. Why do we not help people? Why can't we help people and get them cleaned up? We're allowing them to live in a condition that is, it's just sad. And I don't believe Portlanders would be okay if they could see what firefighters see. And I'm sure police officers see. It's not okay. It's not okay. We need to provide help. Some people are just, if left to their own devices, some people just would be okay on the street, would be fine. But some people are not. And those are the ones that I'm talking about. Like some people just, they need help. They need help. And allowing them to do that is just not helping them. They need help.
When you first came on this show, Isaac, you all were interfacing with a lot of homeless people. And a lot of it was drugs and mental illness. Has that increased? Is it the same amount? Has it decreased? Just ballpark? I mean, you may or may not be tracking it. I don't know.
We are. There is data to track it. The number of fires caused by homeless or due to homeless was up. I think when we talked, the number of homeless, the tents, I think it's the work that the city's doing. There is actually folks in city that are actually actively working to solve this problem, and it's working.
What are they doing that's working?
Well, I mean, we're creating more shelters. There's a place, but some people can't be sheltered in a way. Some people can't be housed in a way. So there needs to be, drug rehabilitation. So all that stuff I think is still coming. So we're not there yet, but it is, you can see like with your, just anecdotally, because where I work, it's definitely lightning. What's not is the fentanyl crisis. The fentanyl crisis is not stopping.
Talk more.
Not even slowing down at all. In fact, I think it's speeding up.
Speeding up.
Well, I mean, and look, the wonder drug, as we call it, Narcan, a fantastic drug that reverses the effects of fentanyl. But what happens is those individuals, they don't want to seek treatment. They don't want to be transported to the hospital. They just want to go get high again, unfortunately.
You're speaking from experience because fire is Narcanning people.
That's right. Yeah, there's also people have Narcan all over the streets.
Yeah.
It's most common we arrive on a patient that has overdosed that somebody on the street or somebody on a bus, somebody has already delivered at least one dose of nasal Narcan. So, we may supplement, we may give that patient more. But once they regain consciousness and they regain the ability to breathe on their own again, they're usually the ones that are with it, that know where they are, that know who they are, where they are, what they're doing. They're alert oriented. If they don't want to go by ambulance, we don't we don't, you know, we let them, they don't want to go. We can't make them. So, they stay, but you know, it's hard because you get sort of compassion fatigue as firefighters. What happens when you go on the same person over and over and over again, like this, it just feels like, the cycle before we had leave behind Narcan is Narcan, and before fentanyl was here, it was heroin. But heroin, rarely did I see somebody do heroin and then again I'd go back on that same person. It was usually they came out of heroin, they were transported, they got treatment, they didn't go and continue to use. Most people, it did happen, but it was nothing like this. Fentanyl is a way different drug, and we are it's really a huge drain on the fire department, because the fire department's core mission is what? Fire protection, life safety, you know, rescue. It was only, you know, at some point along the way, they're like, hey, we could train them as EMTs and then also maybe as paramedics and then send them out into the community to do emergency medical services. Well, that's great, except that now that EMS system is drowning the fire department. There's so much need for an EMS system, and it's basically hurting our ability to be prepared and ready for a fire, for a large scale incident, for car accidents. I mean, we do what we can with what we have, but what the community, whether you know it or not, what you really want, or I live in the city of Portland, what I want from my firehouse is I want my firehouse, my firefighters rested, ready to respond from their station with their tools to save my family if there's an incident. That's what I want. I don't want them tied up on another call. I don't want, you know, that they otherwise shouldn't have been at. I want them rested and I want them ready to go.
One question I got when I told people you were coming on here is, are firefighters ending up at these overdose calls with or without a fire? Or is it ostensibly... Or do these begin as a fire call?
Okay, yeah. So if somebody calls 911 saying, "Hey, I believe this person is overdosed and they're not breathing," which is what happens when you overdose on fentanyl. Essentially, it reduces your respiratory drive down to zero. So if a person's not breathing, doesn't matter how they got there, you're going to get a code 3 fire apparatus. So it's a 4-person truck or engine, and you're going to get a 2-person ambulance response. That's what you're going to get. And traditionally, those has come with police, but as police have been overworked, they've just not been able to make it through these calls. And, you know, so when we arrive, may have been given Narcan, they may not have, but our interest is to get the person breathing again. So Narcan allows that process to happen. If they've not been given it, we immediately administer Narcan to reverse the effects of the overdose and get them breathing again. That's why. If a person's not breathing, you need, this is all, you know, you can, to see how many people you need to successfully resuscitate somebody who's not breathing. The problem is we can't discern from the 911 dispatcher takes the call. We can't discern, was it the drugs that overdosed them? Until we get there and mitigate it, it may have been the drugs. Maybe it's a heart condition. Maybe we need to just do chest compression, CPR. We don't know. And so until we know, everybody has to get dispatched. That's just the way the system works.
And are you preemptively Narcanning people? Is it at that point too? Because if you're saying you don't know and you get to some scene where people aren't breathing.
If we suspect that they may be not breathing due to an overdose, they just get Narcan. There's no contraindications, which means there's no negative effects to giving somebody a dose of Narcan. So if we suspect it was drugs, Narcan.
Do you have any data? I'm really curious about this, and I just haven't been able to find data on it. And maybe that's because we aren't collecting it. We should have enough by now in 2024 is halfway over at least. Do you have data on how many times somebody can be Narcan before there's like pretty severe brain damage or anything?
Yeah, I've heard about this a little bit, but I don't have that kind of firsthand knowledge. I think only time will tell.
I mean, it's not an experiment we want to conduct.
It's happening in real time. People are overdosing on fentanyl and being revived with Narcan multiple times. So, I mean,
we're still keeping track of that. There was a dashboard where you could see.
Yeah. I mean,
We keep anybody that we treat,
we record their information on a charting on a medical chart. But if there's no interventions done by the fire department, we don't record anything because we didn't do anything. For instance, if we arrive on scene and someone's already given them nasal Narcan, and by the time we arrive, they have come to their senses and they refuse treatment, we just say, okay, thank you, have a good day. I mean, as long as they know where the, you know, person, place, time, and event, they can prove that they're alert and oriented. They make their own medical decisions. We're, you know, they don't want help.
So that's a big undercount. That's an undercount.
Sure.
Aaron, do police have Narcan?
Yeah. We moved towards that, gosh, probably 2015, 2014, something like that. And it was something that, you know, initially, you know, there's always the question about what, you know, what should we be providing, you know, because we're not trained EMTs. Narcan is, I mean, it's pretty foolproof from the standpoint that you basically just, it's nose spray and on you go. And the benefit of Narcan, unlike other drugs that might be administered by somebody who's a paramedic, as he mentioned, there's not really any negative side effects that anyone is aware of, at least at this point. And so the consequence of giving someone who's unconscious Narcan, if that's not what's going to help them, is nothing. But it's interesting just listening to this conversation. I mean, you know, Isaac is sitting here talking about Mission Drift, right? He's sitting here talking about an organization that is understaffed, that has been asked to do things that they're not designed to do, but no one else is available to do them.
So they get to do it. Totally normal.
Right. And then here we are, you know, as a police force. So, you know, everything related to addiction and mental health,
I'm asking you if you have Narcan.
Right. But this is a state of
things. It's not, obviously it's not funny. Yeah. Haha. It's just, it's crazy.
It is a sign of the times. And what is so unbelievably aggravating to me is there is a portion of our city political class who wishes to, instead of having hard conversations about why the fire and police bureaus are being required to do work that no one else is willing to do, they castigate the fire and police departments for their actions on those very same calls. We need people to work with us. We need to, again, understand that it's going to take all hands on deck. Everything is and also, not and or. And a compassionate response to someone who's suffering is to look at the downstream upstream causes of their suffering and ensure they don't occur. And the challenge is a lot of the people that we interact with don't want help because of the depths of their despair. And so the challenge is what do you do to ensure that you just are consistent in producing options so that you can try to keep them alive? But we're also not a city that has any interest in discussing sobriety, that has any interest in discussing what our values are around sobriety. And you know, it's like, we talk about Portugal. I went, you know, a lot of the things that were there were interesting, but the biggest thing is they do a lot of education on abstinence from narcotics.
There was a Drug Policy Alliance funded trip to Portugal.
Yep.
The police union was invited,
I was invited.
Yes, but you paid your own way. The union paid for you to go.
Well, my members paid.
Your members paid. And to her credit, I think Jessica Vega Peterson didn't let the Drug Policy Alliance pay either. And Mike Schmidt's office.
He did not. Yeah, he sent
somebody in his stead.
Anna Newell.
Anyway, so you went with a number of people, legislators, yep. State legislators, and you went to Portugal, and I learned from you. I mean, please tell me if I'm misstating this, but it was wild to hear. I learned from you that they, at least when you went, they didn't have guns or fentanyl.
Yeah,
in Portugal,
Europe in general is not a gun-toting.
It seems common sense. When you said it into the microphone, I thought, okay, we're done. I mean, there's nothing more to talk about.
Right.
I don't need to hear about how it's a model of anything.
Right. And then fentanyl, it's interesting too, is, I mean, you know, it is a tidal wave and it crashes over every kind of person suffering from addiction. One thing that I think that is a indication of that, when I was a police officer in downtown Portland in 2005, 2006, as a district officer down here, you had people drinking on nearly every street corner. Alcoholism was kind of the blight of the day. It was a challenge. You know, people who were just kind of daily drinkers, you take them to detox, you kind of work through that. You don't see that very often here anymore. Fentanyl is it seems the king contagion as it relates to addiction, that once it washes over a community, it overtakes all other addictions, but it kills you. And so if you're somebody who, again, who's daily drinking, you might eventually die of alcohol poisoning or whatever else, but you're not going to die every day. You start using fentanyl the way that people drink, if that's their addiction of choice, you're going to die every day, and you're going to need to have Narcan every day. And that is where, again, I just think there's a lot of psychology behind different people with different styles of addiction and different kinds of addiction cycle. But now you have this king contagion that is just, it is the cause, but the use rate, the use style is different. And it's as deadly as any substance we've ever seen in the narcotic world.
What do either or both of you know, if anything, about these alleged, maybe not, I don't know, it sounds like one's being put together, potentially a deflection center in Multnomah County?
Is that the sobering center, or is that different?
It's kind of different, kind of not. So Measure 4002, and again, I've been out of town for a couple of weeks, but there's Measure 4002 introduced the criminal justice system to navigating addiction. Recriminalized is kind of an overstatement. It created a U-class site. The point was, if the only charge through which they are contacted by law enforcement is a low-level possession, that they would be eligible for deflection. Now, what deflection means is up to each county. You're seeing a lot of other counties work and a more custodial structure. And the real challenge for law enforcement, I actually was talking to some electeds today, what is the custodial makeup of these relationships? Because again, law enforcement, we can arrest people for a handful of reasons. We can arrest people for criminal violations. We can put people on civil holds. That's pretty much it, actually.
How do you put people on a civil hold? Because my understanding is it's very difficult to do.
Well, if you're unable to care for yourself and you're a danger to yourself or others.
Sure, but those people are everywhere. What's the criteria here?
It is an assessment by the police officer, but a police officer's hold lasts as long as you get them to a facility. And ultimately, doctors are the ones who can put actual physician 72-hour holds on people. Police officers don't put 72-hour holds on people. Police officers put police officer holds on people to get them from point A to point B. And this becomes the real challenge, is that very often police officers will assess that someone's unable to care for themselves. And then you get them to the hospital and the hospital says, actually, no. I mean, I have literally in my career had somebody actively trying to jump off a bridge, wrestled them off the bridge, gotten them to the hospital and had a doctor say they're not suicidal. And so it's like, and what's so frustrating to me is very, very often police officers will have, you know, some 5, 10, 15 interactions with someone who is acutely and traumatically ill as a result of some kind of addiction spiral or mental health issue. And we will safely navigate them in that moment of crisis 5, 10, 15 times. But then the 16th time they'll end up getting hurt or some kind of negative interaction happens. And the first question is, well, why'd you hurt this person? And the real question should be, why is this person being interacted with 16 times and not getting any help? We've got to get, like, there has to be some next step. And this is a concern with deflection, which is, you know, the state said, we agree, or we believe that voters agree that just giving a ticket's not enough. It's not changing anything. So instead we need to have a center. Then the question becomes, do they have to stay? Do they have to get treatment? Do they just check themselves in and have a conversation? There's a lot of different opinions there. You know, I will say it until I'm blue in the face because it's a good idea. Nicole, who is, and I always forget her last name, so I apologize if she's listening, who's the jail deputy.
It's not Nicole Busher, is it?
I am awful.
Oh, are you talking not sheriff?
No, she's the union president. I will find it out. And if you're listening to the podcast,
Nicole Busher, she's been on the show.
She's wonderful. She has a really good job. Wonderful. I apologize for not remembering last name. Anyway, her suggestion has been multiple times. Look, Inverness has a wing with 250 beds in it.
Yes.
That is completely unoccupied.
Said it on the show.
And,
yes.
And here we are sitting here like, okay, well, we didn't want to do this with Wapato. And it was, you know, the former county commissioner didn't want to use it. There's no way we can go out there because there's no services out there. It's not going to work. Well, Bobby Lake seems to be working just fine. And we have another jail that has an entire unoccupied wing. And I understand that we don't want to put people in jail for addiction, kind of. Although with 4002, we're saying, oh, maybe we do if we don't have any other options. But if we said to people, listen, this wing is different. This is not a custodial like jail. This is a custodial treatment facility because you're indicating that you can't care for yourself. But instead of having a bunch of deputies, because we do have an understaffed jail system, we don't have enough deputies to staff this thing fully with deputies, but we're going to take a bunch of social workers and a bunch of addiction specialists, and you're going to get some help here. And then when we release you, we're not releasing you in downtown Portland where all of these issues remain. We're releasing you out towards Troutdale. And we're going to also ensure that in that area, which is an industrial area, which is significantly underdeveloped, maybe we can find some housing. Maybe we can build some housing. Maybe we can figure out how to ensure that these people have a transition, not in downtown where it's so complicated, but into work, into places that they can actually get help. We have a lot of options, but we don't have the political will to make hard choices. And that to me is just entirely frustrating.
And this is a county. This specifically is a county issue.
The county could fund that jail today.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what Nicole said. I mean, of course it could. It's got billions of dollars. And that's what Nicole said. But also, isn't this quote unquote question, which, you know, Dan Rayfield, who I think was helpful on House Bill 4002 and is currently running for attorney general, he wrote a, I think it was a letter to the county, to Jessica Vega Peterson, the chair, talking about legislative intent behind 4002. And that this idea that you can, as Eli Arnold explained when he came on here, the way he understood it, that the county was saying is, oh, you know, all we have to do is have, we're just going to have the police drop them off there. And there's no requirement that they go in. There's no requirement that they complete treatment.
Yep.
I mean, Eli was even saying, is there a requirement? What's the vicinity, right? Like what is the requirement of square feet within the door that they need to even be within? Like, I mean, that's not clear. So he said, if I drop them off, what?
Well, and how do we get
on the corner? Right. I mean, the idea was the police take them.
Yeah. Well, so but
over
yeah.
and over and over.
Well, and again, from a custodial standpoint, when are they in custody? When are they not? This is the real concern I have, is because, so if we arrest them for the purpose of what? So it's taken to the deflection center. So what if they overdose in the police car? You know, what if we're driving them and they have some kind of deal and the police officers have to use force? Are they in custody for the duration of that transport? Are they in custody when you get to the door? Do you kind of
what
just
if
like,
they make incriminating statements?
Right. I mean, do you get
do you
to
have
the
Mirandizing?
Yeah. Do you get to the deflection center and kind of like nudge them in the door and run off and hope nothing happens? Like these are the kinds of concerns where, again, it's really, really critical that we have value conversations about what police's role is in this. And again, the police taking away someone's freedom is a significant event in someone's life. And it also statutorily is a very important kind of codified reality. So when it begins and when it ends has to be kind of sorted out. I understand talking to a lot of the folks who are going around and having these conversations in other counties that a lot of these issues are being sorted out.
Of course they are.
No other police department in our state has the DOJ there talking to them.
That's
about
right. Consent decree.
Right. And so again,
and to be clear, and there's still a lot of discussion about this. The consent decree started. It was involving mentally ill people.
It was concerns about force used against people who have or perceived to have mental illness. Right. That
not
was the origin story.
People of color. That was not the origin.
No.
I just wanted to clear that out. No, it's morphed over time.
I will always say we need to be better. We need to do our job well.
Of course.
But the DOJ did investigate both and found that there was concerns about, according to them, use of force against mentally ill people. And that was the thing that they felt needed to be addressed.
Period. A narrow scope. What's going on with that right now? Is there still litigation pending in front of Judge Simon in federal court?
So, well, I mean, there will always be until it's over. But
because of when will it be over?
When substantial compliance is reached, the city and the federal government agreed to a court monitor, which is taking the authority to make decisions away from the federal government and giving it to the court monitor. The DOJ still has kind of final kind of say on things, but the court monitor now will be effectively the day-to-day manager. The goal in doing this There was partial termination. So large parts of the settlement agreement, we've agreed that we've substantially complied with. And so they will be removed. And it moves the focus to just a handful of things that we need to kind of finish. I think that it's very clear that all parties have an interest in returning authority of governing law enforcement to the community, because it currently is not. You know, bureaucrats from D.C. Being in charge of decisions for a locality is, I think, not optimal.
Who is the court monitor? Do you know?
It was Mark Smith and his group. I actually met with them for coffee last night. We didn't have coffee. I don't know why I said coffee. I met with them and sat at a table. But it's a group primarily from Los Angeles. They have one person, former chief level person from Albuquerque. And another, I wanted to say, was all well. The other police person was from LA. And then they also have Antoine Edwards, who's a local community representative.
Isaac, what, if anything, do you know about this Multnomah County status of House Bill 4002 and this deflection issue? Because obviously you all are on the front lines with Narcanning people right and left.
Yeah, I mean, I think our role is mitigation of this, of the incident, but it won't be, we won't be involved in the transport. I mean, if, you know, if Portland Street Response or the Community Health Assess and Treat teams are part of that transport, CHAT or PSR, as they're known,
then they're separate.
Our members are on those units.
PSR separate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Our members are on those units as EMTs. We represent all EMTs in the city of Portland, so we'll have to have conversations if we're going to be part of that solution. But you know, I apologize. I only have a couple minutes left.
Yeah.
But,
no, I know. You got to go to a meeting.
Yeah, but I do. I wanted to say I do appreciate this opportunity to speak. Also, you know, Aaron and Kristen being with you guys.
Thank you both.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure, and I think I really appreciate this opportunity. Just to make sure that we have a direct line of communication, and to so people can just hear just straight from people that are doing the work or representing the people that do this work.
Before we wrap up, I just want to clarify something, Aaron. The ballot measures that we can anticipate, does one of them still address Portland Street Response?
Yes.
And strengthen Portland Street Response? Yeah.
And again, I think the most important, like I cannot even begin to say how important it is that we have a real holistic conversation about what a public safety model that is woven, that includes all options. Voters need to have a say in that, because the amount of political hand-wringing about these different groups, taxpayers are paying for all of these groups to work together. And so it is critical from our perspective and based on the polling that we did, that voters ensure that they're directing their government officials to staff, fund, and work together, all of these groups, so that people, when they call, can get the help they need.
Aaron Schmaltz, head of the police union in Portland, and Isaac McLennan, head of the firefighters union in Portland. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.